Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Super real.
Hey, I'm Julian Morgans, and you're listening to What It Was Like, the show that asks people who have lived through big, dramatic events what it was like. So I started last week's episode with this big spiel about the importance of talking. I spoke to this woman whose husband had committed a mass shooting. And my takeaway, like what I learned from the conversation, was that her husband, he hadn't been talking about his feelings. He'd locked himself away until his brain broke, and then he did something awful. If you haven't heard the episode, give it a try. And all this week, I've been thinking about the importance of sharing, of being vulnerable. So here, let me overshare for a moment, because my life's kind of in a funny place right now. So I got married in 2022. And my wife and I, we lasted 3 months and then we broke up. So now I'm a divorced dad and I've been doing some self-reflection. I've been wondering, how did I get here? And one thing I figured out, I got here because I tried to please everyone. I tried to please everyone, so I ended up pleasing no one, including myself. I think I'm such a people pleaser that I basically don't have any boundaries. I will literally get married rather than have a difficult conversation, or professionally too. I have taken so many jobs over the years that in my heart of hearts that I just knew wouldn't work because I'm trying to please people. I think for years I've just been always saying yes and keeping my head down, and you know, I just want everyone to like me and I want to have zero conflict, and so I'm just whoever people need me to be. And man, it's been okay, but I wouldn't really recommend it. So you know what else I've been thinking? I've been thinking about psychopaths. And bear with me here, because I know this is a segue. But psychopaths, they never try people-pleasing. They never do anything they don't want to do. They don't even care what other people think of them. According to this medical journal I found on the website for the U.S. National Library of Medicine, and I'm quoting here, psychopathy is a neuropsychiatric disorder marked by deficient emotional responses, a lack of empathy, and poor behavioral controls, commonly resulting in persistent antisocial deviance and criminal behavior. So yeah, the end part of that wasn't great, but deficient emotional responses, maybe I could get behind that. I like cutting out all of the worry about what people think of me and then like all the running around chasing my own tail, trying to please them all the time. Yeah, not doing that sounds kind of good. Because if you're a psychopath, you don't go around with this pathological need to be liked all the time. And if someone gets mad at you, you don't even notice. So I know this is a weird sentence, but I've been kind of wishing that I was a psychopath. And that's why today on the show, I'm speaking with a psychopath. Her name is Emmy Thomas, and that's not actually her real name. It's a pseudonym that she used to publish her book, Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. Emmy Thomas grew up in a Mormon family in Southern California, and she became a lawyer and a musician. She's also one of the only officially diagnosed psychopaths who has outed themselves in the English language. And believe me, I looked. You've probably read a lot of books by psychopaths, but they'll all be like self-help, business, CEO, success books. This is probably the only time that a self-aware and self-reflective psychopath has written a memoir. So today, Emmy Thomas and I, we're going to talk about how I can stop people-pleasing. Because, as you'll hear, she just doesn't bother. In fact, she says at college, she discovered that she had a unique ability to manipulate people, but then, when it all fell apart, she struggled to understand why their eyes would leak tears. She just kind of stood and watched awkwardly. We talk about her upbringing and how she first discovered she was a psychopath and how the world responded when she outed herself in a book. Spoiler, they weren't impressed. It's really interesting stuff. So I hope you'll enjoy Emmy Thomas and the advice she offers me on how to stop people-pleasing. Emmy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Julian.
Let's start with your childhood and you discovering that you behaved different to other kids. Can you give me an anecdote or two?
I was more weird that I think the kids were scared of me. Like even my siblings were kind of scared of me. They, you know, later had like a word for these moods I would get in where they called it scorched earth, where like whatever whatever thing that we were playing or whatever, I would just turn totally like cold hearted and like shut everything down, but not like in this angry way, like now I am foreclosing on your properties and Monopoly or whatever. And just kind of like ruthless stuff that I think most people just kind of avoid, just kind of stuff like that, I guess.
Yeah. So in the context of your family, this was unusual, right? You were from a fairly regular American family in most other ways.
I wouldn't say so about that either. You know, I was actually from a really kind of out there family. Like, I mean, people kind of like...
I had it completely wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, like we were known as being kind of weird. So we're this big kind of Mormon family that stuck out, you know, in our Southern California kind of upbringing where people had like 2 to 3 kids or whatever. And we ate weird stuff. We you know, like, oh, we can't do that. That's a rated R movie, Mormon stuff, or like, no, drinking coffee or smoking or drinking. So I think that was another reason why I didn't really pick up on the fact that I was so far outside the norm, really until maybe kind of college is when I realized, okay, you know, I'm not just smart. I'm not just Mormon.
Okay, so let's jump to college then. Tell me about what that experience was like.
So college, you know, I had not prioritized my relationships at all. I thought, you know what, I'm really going to try to be a good friend. And it wasn't so much that I valued the person, but I just wanted to become kind of maybe very good at something, like the best, like skilled, like know that I have like this ability, skill in my whatever back pocket, I don't know, build relationships or something. So I started kind of treating people like almost like I was collecting people. And that's probably the thing that backfired the most. Like when I started trying to be kind of a good friend and like kind of really prioritizing relationships is when my relationships got worse, oddly. Mm. You know, I think people could pick up on the fact that it was artificial.
Yeah, I mean, you use the word collecting people rather than befriending them. That's a red flag. People don't like to be collected.
Yeah, I don't like to be collected either.
Yeah. So why were you doing that and how were you doing it?
You know, I didn't really realize it was any different than befriending people. You know, I wouldn't have called it maybe collecting people at the time. I thought this is how we make friends. You know, I have seen American TV shows and American movies where people go off to college and make friends, and this is what I'm doing. And so it was more like, oh, you know, you broke up with your boyfriend. You know, that is so sad. Let's go bowling. You know, and then they'd be like, I don't feel like going bowling. And then you'd be like, dang it, that didn't work, you know, and then what else, like, what else do you say that worked in the movie or whatever? Yeah. So, and so I was really trying to kind of crack the code of these people, and I was kind of frustrated in a way, because it was maybe like the first time that I was bad at stuff, kind of naturally, and did not know how to get better.
So you also, I know that you've talked about being at college and being able to see people's needs quite clearly. Like, you could sort of see through them a bit, and often using that knowledge to manipulate them. Can you tell me about that?
It's just like I have different blind spots from other people. And I often use kind of the example that I learned when I visited New Zealand for the first time, is that it was an island of birds, you know, for a very long time. And so they're ground birds, you know, they're predator birds. They're basically birds that would fit every kind of niche in the environment. And for some of these ground birds, they had developed defense mechanisms against other birds. One of them was that they would just stand very still. You know, if they sense the predator bird above them, they stand very still. And then the thought being that if they don't move, then the predator bird can't see them, then they'll be fine. And then when rats were introduced to the island system, then standing very still does not work very well at all against a rat who's a predator. And so that's kind of what I felt like. I felt like everybody's defense mechanisms were made for people that weren't like me. You know, they were like made for other birds, I guess, you know, like their own kind of social cliques, hierarchies, insecurities, emotional needs being met or not being met. That's kind of what drove a lot of people's behavior, and including their defensive behavior, you know, kind of their defensive mechanisms or the ways that they would try to protect themselves. But sometimes in trying to protect themselves, like the bird standing very still, that made them just more obvious to me or more easy for me to, you know, to understand, you know, even at my peak psychopath self, you know, I was seeing like tens of thousands of opportunities to exploit, I guess, people's vulnerabilities, and just being like, you know, but there's no point to it to me, yeah. You know, and I didn't really have an aesthetic for sadism or for intentionally just trying to hurt people for the sake of hurting people.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I do want to get into that later. But there was two things you said there that I thought was really interesting. So first of all, the people's defense mechanisms had holes in it that you could spot. Can you give me an example of that?
Here's an example. This woman that, or I guess a girl, she was like 16 or 17. She, in Brazil, we were both exchange students. And there was a particular brand of clothing that was popular amongst like teenagers at the time. Triton is how you spell it in English. And so you could get like a, you know, like a regular, I don't know, jacket or something for like $300. Or you could get it just a normal jacket that doesn't say Triton for like $40 or whatever. And she was getting all this Triton gear. And I thought, you know, this is kind of crazy because you're only here for like another couple months. And you know, when you go back to wherever you're going to go back to, no one will have heard of this particular brand of clothing. You know, you've yeah. just like kind of flushed money down the toilet just to be kind of like accepted amongst your peers for this like very short time period. So I think yes. that was like a really interesting example. You can often see those sorts of examples when people are out of their element. I think that's probably easiest to see it. But, you know, people who drive a particular car or make particular comments about things, you can just kind of see that they are invested in certain things and then kind of make certain logical inferences about why would somebody be so invested in the yes. car that they drive.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Absolutely. The car correlation occurred to me when you were talking about this Triton brand of clothing. It's like that's a classic example of the madness of adolescence. We all buy stupid clothing that's overpriced because we want to fit in, and then later in life we all work to service mortgages on houses we can't afford and buy Land Rovers that we shouldn't have, and you know that those instincts never really go away. And I think it's just as transparent later in life as well.
Yeah, I would say actually with the rise of social media, it's easier for me to see people's insecurities because you see kind of those things glorified on social media. Like I've noticed like a surge of people hiking in Patagonia for some reason.
Like, specifically Patagonia. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not like Chile doesn't have mountains, but no one goes there because it doesn't have a cool brand with an awesome logo. All right, so let's. Can you give me an example of what happens in your brain when you see someone crying, especially within the context of college? And I guess this is an illustration of one of your blind spots. You know, do you sort of tap them on the head awkwardly, or like, how do you deal with that?
I think that I've never felt comfortable with people crying. I still don't. I think that I don't know if other people kind of resonate with that. So people would cry and I'd be like, is this kind of a manipulation tactic? Was my first, always my first guess. And then if it kept going and it kind of seemed serious, I thought, wow, I did not see this coming. You know, they have definitely jumped off the tracks of what I projected them to say and do today. I don't know how to kind of deal with this. I don't really have like the skills, you know, like, and I think that's interesting that I never really predicted people crying. So that's a example of a blind spot. And number two blind spot is I didn't know what to do about the crying. I was like, I didn't, my sister, you know, she cried a lot too. And I spent some time in between university and law school back at home. And so with my sister, who's like quite a bit younger, and I would just be like, I don't understand. She's like constantly leaking either from her allergies or from crying. It's like every day there's a new reason to be leaking from her like mouth or nose, even her like eyes, you know.
Even just that language there. She's, you know, you're so far removed from this experience of crying that you just
They're
see
just
it like as
like tissues leaking. Everywhere.
Do you... I mean, when friends continue to cry to this day, do you see it as just a bit of a time waste? Are you kind of like, all right, well, I guess that's me for the next 15 minutes. I'm going to have to stand here.
That's a good question. I mean, now I think I see it, and maybe it's because I've learned a little bit more about crying and learned that like the act of crying, I think processes, like it's just, so I guess I see it as like a bodily function that way where it's like, okay, somebody's experiencing in the same way that I don't really feel compelled to talk to somebody like during an orgasm or whatever and kind of like walk them through it. I'm like, this is kind of just something they're going through on their own. That's probably how I see it now.
Okay. That's yeah, I'd say that's a unique perspective. All right. So it sounds like throughout your upbringing and throughout your college years, there was just a lot of moments where you were like, I behave differently.
Yeah.
So tell me about, how did you discover that you're a psychopath?
So I was talking to, during law school, I had this internship. So me and my office mate would just spend the hours just like chatting, hanging out, talking. And she was a really interesting person. She had like a lot of unusual characteristics herself. So I think because she was so different, I was very honest, I guess, with her about my own things. So I would talk very freely with her about, you know, like, oh, it's so weird. You know, let me tell you some of my weird experiences being a Mormon or at BYU or now in law school, and just kind of tell her all these different things, trying to get her take about it, kind of like the same way I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
And after like a month of this or something, she said, have you considered the possibility that you're a sociopath? And I didn't take offense to that because I think she used the word sociopath, you know, and I didn't know really what that means. Psychopath seemed like a bad thing or something like American Psycho. But I looked it up, sociopath, and I read the diagnostic criterion, and it was from Herbie Cleckley, who wrote The Mask of Sanity, I think is the name of his book. So his diagnostic criterion from kind of like the 30s and the 40s. And then it was Robert Harris PCLR checklist. And I kind of just went through and I thought, yeah, this actually does fit, you know, like superficially charming, like kind of glib, you know, like no real empathy, you know, kind of confident. What were some of the other ones? Like failure to learn from experience. There's something about like the safety of yourself and others, like a disregard for the safety of yourself and others. And I thought of all these times where I was like, that was a close one. You know, that could have been death.
Failure to learn from your experience is interesting as well.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, it's my girlfriend and I call it psychopath stupid. where you just, part of it's because you feel like Teflon. You feel like nothing really, even if you experience negative consequences, they don't last. You know, you don't dwell on them. You don't kind of beat yourself up about them. You move on very quickly. You have like this like superpower ability to compartmentalize and just be like, that was then, this is now kind of thing. And the consequences is that you know, you fail to learn from experiences. I think it's kind of obvious because if you don't feel the negative, you know, whatever happened, you'll just keep doing the thing, right? You know, you keep cheating on people and people break up with you, for instance, or something. And you're like, well, I didn't care about that relationship anyway. So you keep cheating. You know, you have to actually kind of care about the thing and care about the loss of a thing for it to really sink in, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So this sounds like a bit of a self-diagnosis at this point.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess she told me and then I looked at it and kind of recognized it. But, you know, at the time, I kind of was like, oh, ha, 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 that's probably true. And then didn't think anything of it, really.
Yeah, yeah. You just immediately compartmentalized and moved on.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, okay, you know, like finding out that I'm like 7% German ancestry or something. Like, who cares?
A lot of people really care about that stuff.
Yeah, but to me, I mean, especially it seemed to have no relevance to my life because I wasn't struggling at the time. I had not made the realization that the reason why I didn't get in that music school was my professor. You know, I didn't. I was just kind of like cruising along. You know, I felt like footloose and fancy free, like the world was my oyster or whatever. And so none of it seemed to matter to me.
Yeah, cool. Okay. So then when was the more official diagnosis and how did that feel?
So I didn't really care about any sort of diagnosis at all or like even think about the word psychopath or a sociopath, I guess, at the time, until like this would have been around like 2008 or 2009. Early 2009, late 2008. I had like a bunch of relationships and I was like struggling socially in my little kind of like Mormon community. There were some issues. I no longer had a job. We'll just put it that way for safety. Okay. And I, like a major friendship, you know, had collapsed. There was like a couple romantic relationships that were kind of going on at the same time that collapsed. And I suddenly found myself with like a lot of time for just sitting around ruminating, kind of being like, what happened, you know, to everything. And I started thinking about the word sociopath again.
I mean, it sounds like you inadvertently blew up a lot of your life through your behavior.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if it's inadvertent. I actually think that to me, kind of what happened, I realized, you know, at that time I was like, you know, this is not the first time this has happened. And I can kind of see the ways that I started to, you know, not show up for things or people is a good way to put it.
Like, were you just sort of being a bad friend, being a bad employee?
Yeah. Yeah, basically. I mean, when you kind of think about it, like when people are dissatisfied with something, you know, I think they stop showing up in a lot of different ways, you know, like they don't care. They like roll up to work and basically looking like pajamas or something. They don't return anybody's phone calls. They don't keep their commitments. They don't, you know, do a good job with anything that they have committed to do and like actually do kind of end up doing. And I think it's, you know, like they're not really motivated to do any particular thing. And it's just like everything seems stupid and meaningless and boring. And so it's not like the stuff kind of happens out of nowhere. Like if you had any self-awareness at all, which I didn't have that much, but I was starting to like recognize, hey, you know, this was basically self-sabotage.
Okay, right. So you sounded like you're a bit unhappy during that period.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is one of the things that surprises people about psychopaths is that psychopaths, probably one of the most common negative ways in which they experience their condition is like a chronic and pervasive sense of boredom and meaninglessness and kind of emptiness about life and like their existence.
Yeah, I mean, that feels to me like the cliche that we see on movies. A pervasive sense of boredom that psychopaths in Hollywood cure with random acts of violence.
Yeah. yeah, novelty seeking, yeah, violence. I could see it for sure.
Okay. So you were doing some self-analysis and you're like, oh, that's right. I had a self-diagnosis of psychopathy in my college days. Maybe I'll revisit that.
Yeah. So I started kind of, I had always kind of journaled, you know, on and off, especially when I would go through one of these periods where I was like, what just happened? You know, like, I don't even understand myself. Like, why did I do all these things? Why did I start this job just to, like, you know, like, run it into the ground kind of thing? Why did I start this relationship just to ruin it? You know, so to try to kind of understand myself, I would journal. And this, at this time, kind of blogs were popular. A couple of my siblings had, like, blogs for their kids at the time, you know, oh, look at, the, you know, the, like, they got a new trike or whatever. Look at this or something. And so I thought, oh, just, like, kind of blog this journal process. And so I started a blog called Sociopath World. And I was writing it for like a year or two. And then my current literary agent contacted me and was like, hey, have you ever thought about writing a book about any of this? And she and I kind of together thought, you know, in order for that to kind of make any sense, I should figure out whether I actually am a psychopath and get a diagnosis, or, you know, to find out one way or the other. So that's what I did. And it was John Edens, who is a psychologist that at the time taught at Texas A&M. And I just one Saturday drove over from where I was living in Texas over to Houston, the 3 hours or whatever, and sat there with him for like 4 or 5 hours. He had me do a couple, I think it's called self-report tests ahead of time. So he had looked at some of those. He had had me like send some other kind of background information in, and a couple other kind of histories, self-reported histories. I think he contacted a couple people that I knew to verify some stuff. And that's how I ended up getting diagnosed.
Were you like a strong psychopath on the, I'm assuming it's a spectrum.
Yeah, it is a spectrum. And he noted, I don't know what it means to be a strong psychopath. I actually think you can be strong in certain traits and less strong in other traits. And so it's somewhat difficult to say. But I think that he did note in my kind of report that notably is what he said, I scored in the 99th percentile or above, even when you include all genders, which usually female psychopaths score lower than male psychopaths on the criteria. But he said, even with male people, I'm still scoring it in the 99th percentile or above.
Okay. And how did you digest this news?
You know, it was like, I probably had mixed feelings at the time. You know, part of me, I think, was like, okay, yeah, you were right. So pat on the back.
Nailed it.
Yeah, nailed it. Confirmation bias was correct there. Yeah. And then part of me was kind of like, you know, it's not a death sentence, you know, but there still is not any known kind of treatment especially at the time, which this was been 2010. There were all the studies that they kind of had at that time, I believe, said that if you try to treat them, they actually get worse.
Hold on, would you want to be treated? I mean, yeah. That feels to me like what, gay correction camp or something.
But no, like, totally I would want to be treated. But I'll tell you kind of why. The main thing, why? To me, the psychopathy felt like, my own experience of it felt like, I just had a very weak sense of self, you know, like, so I was able to be like a chameleon and be whatever anybody needed and kind of like mold to whatever role, because I had no connection to like my identity or ego. Like, you could criticize me, but also praise didn't matter either. You know, right, not okay. Ultimately, not like in the long run, I guess. Like, I might be like, oh, ha, 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 pat on the back or something. But the next day, it's like, it's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch. Like, every day it would like erase. You'd start over. Yeah. There was like no sense of continuity. There was no sense of meaning or purpose about anything that I was doing.
Hey, we're just going to stop here for a quick ad break. But stick around. We'll be right back with more What It Was Like.
Thank you. If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So let's put all that together into some sort of one simple package. What's it like being a psychopath?
I think to be a psychopath is to be just really, I think it's like kind of being like a gas form of water, like water vapor or something, instead of like ice, you know, like you have like this kind of ultimate flexibility, but there's no real stability there either. That's kind of what it feels like inside, is just like anything, any day, any moment could be different. There's not really a continuity of thinking this was me in the past and I feel identified with that person in the past. There's not really a continuity of thinking this is me in the future and, you know, I feel identified with that person in the future. In fact, my girlfriend, when she was going through therapy, her therapist really worked with her hard on trying to have empathy for her future self. Because she just didn't, you know, she would make all these choices and, you know, basically like really short-sighted choices to benefit her present self that would end up being bad for her future self. So that was like something that she had to learn to do. But it just kind of feels really almost like I sometimes do these meditations where they're like, imagine you're an alien. You just got plopped down into this body and you have like no context for the past or no expectations for the future. That would be kind of a good way to describe it. Really alien, like you don't belong here, and there's not really any connection you have to what's going on.
This sounds good and bad.
Yeah.
Before you mentioned the word Teflon, you know, like things don't really stick. They just, bad experiences slide off you. I guess good ones do too. But I think there's a lot to be said for that. You don't have the burden of carrying, you know, weight around, trauma around, problems around, regrets. It just sort of, you compartmentalize, you move on. That sounds great to me. That sounds like a very Zen place to be.
Well, I think there's wisdom to, like, these Buddhist monks who are trying to get to become free.
Yeah. Okay. So you release your book, Confessions of a Sociopath, and it had a pretty mixed effect on your life. I know that your employer wasn't very happy about it. You know, a few things happened. Talk me through that process.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say mixed. I would say, like, really bad. So I was affiliated with 3 different law schools, and, you know, they all fired me. They all were like, no, we don't want anything to do with you. But one of them in San Francisco, I feel like they were particularly bad and super discriminatory, but they banned me from being within, like, 1 kilometer of the law school. And the law school was, like, in the middle of downtown San Francisco. So basically they're trying to tell me that I can't come into downtown San Francisco anymore because they're so worried that I'm going to murder their students. And that was literally the emails that they were sending me. And I was like, this is completely illegal. You have no right to do this, to ban me of anything. You know, like, you can get a restraining order if you want, but this has, like, no legal force. And they were like, try us, basically. You know, like, if we see you, or if you even approach a student, or if a student even sees you on the sidewalk, they're going to call the police and you will be arrested. I was like, I bet I will not be arrested. But this is what they were, like, threatening. This is how serious they thought it was.
Jeez, you must have really freaked someone out in upper management.
Yeah.
So obviously in pop culture, psychopath seems to be a bit of a synonym for serial killer. And
which I think is crazy, you know, because why? How and why?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, have you ever killed anyone?
No.
No? No? Well, would you like to?
No. And why would I like to kill somebody is, like, a good question. You know, the psychopaths that did kill people, they had, like, way, way more messed up things going on. So I can think of a couple that had, like, kind of similar things. One of them, Ted Bundy, classic psychopath, I think.
Yeah.
Ted Bundy, I think a little known story. He got kind of, like, turned down by a woman or something. I'm going to get the details wrong about this. I apologize. But the gist of it is this. He got turned down by a woman. He, like, worked for, like, 5 years or something to, like, get her to like him or something. She finally agrees. And then the moment she says, like, yeah, we're dating or something, he dumps her. So it was, like, this big, weird, long con that he was, like, doing. But probably just because he had, like, nothing else that was interesting to him. And he's like, yeah, I'll just do this. Another one, but Ted Bundy, you know, I think the weirdness from him is that his mom, he grew up thinking his actual mom was his sister, right? And his grandparents were his parents. And they told him at, like, age 12, which is there, like, a worse time to tell a young boy that your sister's your mom than, like, during puberty?
Yeah.
Like, you can just kind of see, like, and I also thought, like, why is this keep happening? Because the same thing happened to, you know, Paul Bernardo, Canadian serial killer, kind of spree killer.
You're good at serial killer names. Even
well,
if you're...
it's my girlfriend is really into the serial killers, especially right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's listening to a bunch of podcasts.
So you're two psychopath women listening to lots of true crime talking about serial killers. This is a really nice little thing.
Yeah, that's what we do. She comes home from work, we walk on the beach, and she tells me about her podcast or whatever. But yeah, Paul Bernardo, same thing. He like found out that his mom was his sister, some other weird thing. And I'm like, no wonder these people end up with, like, issues. Luckily, though, my mom's my mom, my sister's my sister. So I think I, like, narrowly missed any sort of issues there.
Sure. And I've heard you argue that these kind of psychopaths, you know, Ted Bundy, they're not true psychopaths because they seem to have very weak egos. They're very much... they carry around all these, like, mummy issues and stuff. And I've heard you argue that actually that's not in line with the traditional or a sort of diagnostic understanding of psychopathy.
I don't know. I do think Ted Bundy's like a psychopath. I just kind of think that I see psychopathy more this way. It's kind of just like, it's like a layer that you put on top of, like, whatever else is happening, kind of like a frosting or something. apart from psychopathy. It's like the hormones. Like, are you male or female? Are you, how were you raised? You know, did you think your mom was your sister? Did you have like any, were you abused, sexually abused? Was there a physical abuse? Was there like food scarcity? Was there, you know, there are all these other kind of traumas that you could experience. You know, I have no desire to harm people. I have no aesthetic for violence. But I could see, you know, if I was raised in like the way that some of these serial killers were, you know, I could see, you know, yeah, maybe that would have been different. I don't know that I would become a serial killer. I probably would have to also be male, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
I've done some back of the envelope calculations on this, like really dirty, you know, obviously they wouldn't be peer reviewed or whatever, but you can, and you know, statistically unsound and stuff, but just with raw numbers, you can, I've taken like situations where let's take you have a person that's genderless, right? And if you make them male, they're more likely to be violent than if you make them a psychopath, right? Like actually maleness has a stronger correlation with violence depending on what cherry picked numbers that you use. It's probably not psychopathy that causes violence or causes, you know, them to be killers. It's probably that they're male and they have these other issues, and the psychopathy kind of just allows for that thing to exist without kind of checking it. You know, it's like, yeah, the psychopathy is like, okay, I don't have empathy. And so now that is kind of a check on behavior that's been like removed. You know, like it's easier for them probably to kill. But just because it's easier to kill doesn't mean that people are more likely to do it. I mean, children are very violent, too. And we just we're not afraid of them because.
Because they're kids. They're, they look cute.
Yeah. Sweet. And we can physically, if we had to, subdue them or whatever.
Sorry, you can beat up a kid pretty easily.
So we're not afraid. But, you know, that's. Psychopaths are kind of like that. They're very much like they have the emotional kind of maturity and kind of self-control of like a four-year-old.
All right, look, I want to talk about me for a bit because I hit you up because I feel like I'm overburdened by my lifelong dedication to empathizing. I walk around, I'm empathizing with everyone from like complete strangers in the supermarket to people on TV to, I have this new thing where like, if I'm walking down the street and I see like a line of ants crossing the footpath, I'll be really careful to do a big step over the top. Or if I'm like riding my bike and I see a line of ants, I've got to ride around the ants. And, you know, just little things like that, that it seems to me that maybe you wouldn't, that's not a problem in your life. Maybe I guess I'm feeling like, my life's hard in ways that it doesn't need to be. And your life's easier in ways that I would like to enjoy. Another example is, so I sent you this email when I invited you on the show to do this interview. I was like, Emmy, I'd love to get you on. We'll talk about this and we'll talk about that. And, you know, the email is like, you know, it's a full essay. And you wrote back one word. You wrote, sure, full stop. And I was like, God damn it. Like that is some Ninja Warrior level reply skills. Like I just could never send that reply. I'd have to put in some smiley faces and exclamation marks and it'd take me like 4 hours. I just want to be kind of more like you, I guess. Is that weird? Is it weird that I'm kind of almost jealous of the way you think?
No, I'm jealous of the way you think about certain things. You know, I think that everybody has kind of things that they do well, and if they're things that you feel have you've become a little bit a slave to.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me more about how you think, and in, you know, ways that I can try to emulate that.
Well, I think people pleasing is often inefficient because the ways that we're trying to predict to please others don't end up pleasing them. You know, it's actually more about like their own self concept than it is about like actually trying to please the person. So number one, I would, you know, kind of start asking like, am I really doing this for them or is it somehow about me? Am I doing this for me? And if so, if I am doing it for me, then why? You know, what is the thing? I think it's fine to just to understand that your life is your own and you don't really need to, like, there's not like going to be a judge or a jury or somebody kind of making the assessments about whether you're a good person or not. Yeah. I think it's fine to have, like, I guess for me, I don't even think about morality most of the time in decisions. I think about aesthetics. And I think that helps me to have a little bit more clarity with understanding things. And so that's maybe a good distinction too. Like, you could ask yourself, am I bringing somebody flowers because, you know, because of them, or because I kind of have an aesthetic, I want to be the guy that brings flowers, or I want to be the guy that opens doors or something. And once you understand that it's you doing that, I think you can just take more pleasure in it and be like, I'm doing this for me. You know, and I think it becomes less of a burden when you understand that you're actually doing it for you. You're that type of guy. And I totally understand that.
I mean, I think there's a third option there that you didn't mention, is that maybe I would bring flowers because I want to be liked. It's a pathological need to be liked by everyone. And I think that's exhausting sometimes. Do you want to be liked?
Not really. But I would also say, Julian, that I don't know that they're liking the real you. If you're just putting on like a show of like, I'm going to bring flowers in order to achieve this outcome, which is to be liked, you know, you're going to constantly be doing things that kind of aren't your natural inclination. They'll never get to know the real you. Like, if you really want to be truly liked for who you are, then you have to be as authentic as you can be, as often as you can be, because that's how people will come to understand who you are. You know, they'll never get to know the real you if you're often just kind of putting on an act or a show. And so being your authentic self really just helps people to connect with you in like a more authentic way.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's when they'll really like you.
I mean, I think that's solid advice, but I can't help but notice what feels to me like an inconsistency here, right? So you talk about, you've written about a lot, and you've spoken on other podcasts about sort of passing, you know, going through life and putting up this mask as like just a regular person. When on the inside, there's a whole other thing going on.
Yeah.
So if you're doing that not to be liked, why are you doing that?
Number one, I'm speaking, I guess, from experience when I advise you this. Like, when you try to pass all the time, you're spending all your time passing. What's the point? What's the real point? Yeah. So what if you're liked by somebody, like the moment that you drop the mask or whatever, and then they stop liking you, then you're like, well, why did I invest all this time, this energy, this effort? In a way, that's okay. So I'm trying to tell you, hey, that's like a dead end.
It's like you tried it and it didn't work for you. It just burned you out.
Sucks. Boo.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Did you ever try passing with your girlfriend? You know,
No, luckily. Straight in. Yeah. When she first was dating me, I had already kind of graduated, is what my therapist would have said. At least every other week therapy.
As like a public-facing psychopath.
Yeah. And she had just started therapy. She was like 9 months in or something, you know. And we've been together now like 6 years or something. So she was still kind of like, you know, solidly 1 foot in like the Teflon playground psychopath, you know, just doing whatever, not thinking about anything, you know, very moment to moment. So that's always been a little bit the struggle. And I think almost in like this very literal computer-like way, we try to communicate like our expectations with each other, like very overtly. Like, this is my expectation of you. I'm telling you my expectation. It is that, you know, you return my phone call within 6 hours after I have called you or something.
Oh, I love that. I love that, because then it's so easy to get it right. And so it just makes it so much harder to get it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of think she probably pushed back more on that than I did. So I said, you know what? I really don't want to be held accountable for any expectation that you haven't voiced explicitly to me.
So that's such a great sentence. I'm going to borrow that. I got questions to finish with. What does the general public not understand about psychopathy?
I think there's almost like a really bad negative feedback loop happening with psychopaths, where psychopaths feel like they have to pass and basically to lie to people in order to not have things happen like happened to me, you know, where I got banned from being in downtown San Francisco, allegedly, you know, just fired for no reason. Like, I'm not a law professor. I'll never be a law professor. And all because I came out as being a psychopath, you know, like, that is a serious consequence. And so people who want to avoid that consequence and maintain their jobs or maintain their relationships or whatever, they won't come out, right? As long as that's what's going to happen. The flip side is, I think normal people are freaked out by the fact that there are psychopaths amongst them that they don't know about, you know? Yeah. And they're like, you know, they're pretending, they're lying. And so it's kind of like normal people are complaining about psychopaths lying and pretending to not be psychopaths. But there's like normal people are the reason why psychopaths are lying and pretending. Psychopaths are literally afraid of what normal people could do to them. And normal people are afraid of what psychopaths could do to them. So there's this fear that's kind of keeping people from a better situation. The better situation to me would be that normal people, kind of, again, like autism spectrum disorder, you just understand that psychopaths are different. They're going to see things differently, and you can treat them the same, basically. I mean, like, if they do bad things, send them to prison, you know? Like, if they can't, you know, be good citizens, then, like, give them the consequences or whatever. It's not like I'm saying, like, give them a free pass. I'm just saying, you know, don't target them just for being a psychopath.
Yes. I think that's good advice. I think I don't think you should target anyone for anything.
Yeah.
Except don't be a serial killer.
Killer, then you are going to prison. You
know? Totally. Totally. Emmy, I have loved this. It's been really interesting. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
You can keep up with Emmy Thomas at her website, sociopathworld.com. That's all one word, sociopathworld.com. And I'd recommend you check out her book. Like I said, she's basically the only self-aware psychopath to write a memoir. It's called Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Tuffery. It was mixed by Jimmy Saunders, who also did our theme music. Evie Atkins is our intern. Our cover art is by Naomi Lee Beveridge, and this whole thing has been a Super Real production.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.